Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your hosts, Dr. Amandeep Hansra, Dr. Dana Pung, and myself, Dr. Elise Putt. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers. Hello, and welcome back to another season of the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast. We are so excited for everything we have in store for you in 2025. We have some great guests coming up on the show, and we are hard at work planning our conference. The conference will take place in Melbourne this year. It's Saturday, August 23rd and Sunday, August 24th. So pop those dates in your calendar and make sure you're following on socials and subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss any of the big announcements of speakers and tickets and all of that. In the meantime, things may sound a little different around here, with Dr. Dana Pung having welcomed another member of her family and taking a bit of time off the show. We've got Dr. Amandeep Hansra stepping in for a few more episodes than usual. So you'll be hearing from myself, Dr. Elise Putt, and Dr. Hansra a bit in the interim. Our first guest back for the season is Dr. Jeremy Robertson. He is a pilot and aviation medical officer. He's currently working at Qantas. He started his career as a pilot and was grounded in 2010 following a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. He took this as an opportunity to retrain and became a doctor, all while maintaining his passion for aviation and advocating for himself and those in similar positions to himself. He actually became the first Australian pilot with type 1 diabetes to be issued a Class 1 aviation medical certificate, which allowed him to restart his professional pilot career after his work in changing the rules around flying with type 1 diabetes. Hi, Dr. Jeremy Robertson. Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast.
Hi, Dr. Elise. It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Can you kick us off by giving us a bit of a summary of the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, I have a funny job. I wear two hats. So the simpler job to explain is 2 days a week I work as a Boeing 737 first officer. And then the other 3 days of the week, I'm an aviation medicine officer or aviation medical officer, which for the airline I work for means that I'm really looking after the pilots most of the time. So helping with their annual medical checks to make sure they're fit to stay flying. And when they do go through periods of illness, I'm usually involved in their clearance to return to work. So that's the bulk of the work. And then there's a little bit of project work that sort of fills in the gaps.
Amazing. So two very different worlds from what I understand. And to clarify, the first officer, what does that mean to non-airline folk?
So that means I'm second in charge of the airplane. There's always two pilots up the front of a commercial airliner. So there's the captain who sits in the front left-hand seat and the first officer who sits in the front right-hand seat. So that's me, front right-hand seat.
Amazing. I want to go back to the beginning. So you were a pilot before you were a doctor. Can you tell me about when you first thought about becoming a pilot?
Oh, well, I feel like I'm so old now that I can't remember ever not wanting to be a pilot. I have very early memories as a child of my dad taking me out to sit at the end of the runway in Canberra and watch the aeroplanes. And then during high school in year nine, I specifically remember failing a career suitability test that the careers advisor got everyone to do because there was no job description of being a pilot. So I had just indicated that I wasn't interested in all the other 200 job descriptions there, which resulted in a zero score. But really the test did its job because it kind of crystallized in my mind that actually as a career, that's what I was interested in. So I actually changed schools after that because there was a school in Canberra that had pilot theory as a high school subject. So you could do your private pilot's license theory training as part of year 11 and 12. So I did that and popped out of year 12 with my private pilot's license, moved up to Sydney and started at UNSW and did the Bachelor of Aviation course at UNSW. And that finished off all my remaining professional qualifications. And then, yeah, went from there, went out working.
Yeah, wow. So I'm not very familiar with the process of becoming a pilot. It sounds like you've just described it there, but what particular things do you have to do? What are the tick boxes to get through pilot training?
I guess it's a ladder, like any series of professional qualifications. The entry level stuff is the recreational pilot's license and private pilot's license. And if you just want to fly as a hobby or fly yourself as part of your own business or something like that, then that's where you would stop at the private pilot level. But to be employed as a pilot and receive income as a pilot, you have to have a commercial license. So that's then the next professional qualification. They all involve theory exams, a minimum quantity of practical training and a practical exam. And then once you have a commercial license, then there's sort of other add-ons. So you can do an instrument rating, which allows you to fly without reference to the outside world. So fly inside the clouds and at night. And then, again, more little professional components to add on for different types of airplanes. So airplanes with retractable undercarriage, so where the wheels fold up. Airplanes that have a gas turbine engine, so jet engines rather than piston engines. And you can just add more and more of these things. And then the top tier is the air transport pilot's license, which is what's required to fly in command on an airliner, basically. And that's a large series of theory exams. And you must have a minimum of 1,500 hours of flying training before you're allowed to sit the flight test for that. So it's quite a long process. You can kind of go from naught to commercial pilot's license in about 12 to 18 months if you do it full time and nothing else. But then that last transition through to air transport pilot license always takes a bit of time.
Interesting. I think that is more in depth than what I had imagined. I always imagined that you'd have to go through a pretty rigorous training, but didn't really know much about the process. At that point in your career, had you thought about medicine at all? Do you remember it crossing your mind in high school? Sounds like no, if you clicked no to every other option.
Yeah. Not in high school. One of my good friends at high school, that she was on a mission to become a doctor. Absolutely. So I was aware of what marks were needed out of high school, and I certainly didn't attain those. And then she and I actually ended up living at the same residential college in Sydney, and she was successful in getting medicine at UNSW. And there were a couple of other students at the college I lived at that were doing medicine. And that was really my first exposure to medical training. And I always remember being interested in their textbooks. You know, I just like to know how stuff works. I found it fascinating reading about the human body. But again, I was on my professional mission to go become a commercial pilot. So I never really considered medicine as a career. I just knew that I found it interesting at that point. That's all.
And how did the journey into medicine come about?
Well, so I guess I can't talk about that without talking about the tail end of my commercial flying career. So I was flying for Qantas. I was a Boeing 767 first officer, which is a great job because we used to do a mix of domestic flying and the sort of Southeast Asia and the Pacific international flying. And during the GFC, Qantas had too many pilots, so we were all doing sort of a reduced roster. I was flying about two-thirds of a normal roster, which meant I had a lot of spare time. And I've always kind of needed a bit of a project on the side of flying to keep the academic component of my brain active. And I'd started an aerospace engineering degree. So I was doing an aerospace engineering master's degree, just one subject a semester. And I found that sort of fitted into the spare time I had around work at Qantas really well. And it was a really good sort of adjunct to the work I was doing at Qantas as well. And I was 31 years old. It was 2010. And I got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which was pretty out of the blue. No family history, no autoimmune diseases of any kind. And at that point, type 1 diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes of any kind, was a black and white, no, you cannot hold a Class 1 aviation medical, which is the level of medical certification you require to fly as a commercial pilot. So my flying career just kind of stopped overnight. All those professional decisions I'd made from age 15 to get where I was all just stopped. But I was halfway through that engineering master's, so that was a godsend, to be honest, because it just gave me something to do whilst I sorted out medical termination from Qantas and sorting out my life in the background. And I finished the engineering degree, and that would have been the logical direction to go. Now, qualified engineer, segue into that career. But the act of doing my thesis had really made it clear to me that whilst I found it interesting, I couldn't see myself making a career of it. There were aspects of an engineering career that I felt were lacking. One of the things I loved about flying was the small teamwork aspect of it. And I felt that while I recognized I needed a technical career of some description, I needed something that had more people involvement. So I thought, yeah, I just kept coming back to medicine. And I thought I was young enough still to have a crack at the GAMSAT and just see how I went and just have one good hard shot at it. And if I got in, great, I'd pursue it. If I didn't, great, I wouldn't die wondering and I could just go and pursue another career. So I did a couple of those prep courses that tail you for the GAMSAT because I don't think, as a pilot, you don't really write very much. And I couldn't remember the last time I'd written an essay, let alone more than a couple of lines in an email, to be honest. So I distinctly remember the pain of learning how to write an essay again. But I did okay in the GAMSAT, interviewed, as you do, at all the available unis, and was offered a spot at Sydney Uni. And yeah, there started the medicine journey. And that was 2012. I started med school.
Yeah, wow. That's quite a journey into medicine, especially not necessarily having considered it for a long time. But that period where you got made medically, what's the word that you use?
Oh, it's an appalling word. It's a medical termination, but that's probably not the correct term. But no. Yeah, I couldn't meet the inherent requirements of the role of my job. So I retired, resigned, not sure which anymore, but anyway, I stopped working there and here I am.
Yeah, certainly. Well, when you've got all of those really, really niche specialty skills and no real reason to plan for what if, even if you're still doing your master's, which sounds like it could have been a good backup plan. Had you ever thought about that? Is that something that is on your mind as a pilot? Oh, there's a possibility that I could have to go into something else one day if I were to get a medical condition, or even if for other reasons, the stress of the job wasn't compatible with the life that you wanted to live.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, you know, it's every pilot's worst nightmare, especially from a commercial pilot's point of view. So I think there are those that really try hard not to think about it and those that certainly do plan for a backup. Pre-COVID, I think there are a lot of people that just didn't think about it, but COVID for commercial pilots was a huge reality check because even the perfectly fit and healthy pilots suddenly found themselves without a job for an extended period of time. And people went and did all manner of different jobs during that period.
Mm.
So I think if you talk to pilots now, there's probably a greater awareness of just how useful a secondary qualification is, or at least a very decent income insurance plan. And pretty much all, by the time you get to airline flying, all pilots are insured against losing their license or their medical, because it is such a niche qualification that really doesn't transfer well to other professions.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you went into medicine, did you have the idea that you do aviation medicine in mind?
Not really. One of the attractions to medicine was that it's just so broad that I felt I was bound to find some area that I loved and would end up specializing in. Speaking broadly, as a pilot, I loved the physical manipulative aspects of the job. I enjoyed the fact that it was sort of three-dimensional problem solving. I liked the small team environment. So translating that to the medical world, straight away, I was thinking about surgical, anesthetic, emergency medicine type roles. And the entry-level aviation medicine qualification is to become a designated aviation medical examiner. That's just a short 2-week course you do to be allowed to examine pilots for their annual recurrent medicals. And I always knew I was going to do that because given my background, I knew I would just always do that on the side of whatever the core of my medical career was. But I guess the short answer is no. When I got into medicine, I did not have a clear idea of where I was going to go with it at all.
And how did you find it going from the world of aviation that is so regimented? And I've read the Checklist Manifesto, and that's what comes to my mind thinking about the comparison yep. of airplanes versus the medical world. What was the transition like?
Oh, well, there were some fascinating comparisons. Because aviation is so structured, so regimented, and there's a reason it's such a safe form of transport, is it's just been analysed to the nth degree and, yeah, so regimented, so black and white. And then coming to medicine, where it's just shades of grey, infinite shades of grey in terms of diagnosing things, treatment decisions. That was a really interesting comparison. It took me a while to get my head around. So, yeah, that was one very interesting comparison.
Can you tell me a bit about how you got into the aviation pathway? How you ended up where you are now? You said entertaining, more care things. Do you remember what point along the way you opted to do aviation?
Yeah, internship was kind of a process of elimination. I spent time working in a major specialty and go, yeah, this is interesting, but I don't have that inbuilt burning passion to pursue it as a career. And so I rotated through my 2 years, my year of internship, and ruled out most of the major hospital-based specialties. And I quite enjoyed obstetrics because it had that great mix of some procedural stuff, lots of people interaction, clinic-based work. And I think women gave birth between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday to Thursday. I probably would have become an obstetrician, but I just watched the lifestyle of the registrars in particular and then the consultants. And I just thought, I can't survive with that level of shift work for the rest of my life. I spent 2 years working in an emergency department, a fantastic emergency department at that, really well supported and great bunch of people to work with. Again, I enjoyed the work because it was that same thing, lots of on your feet procedural stuff, people skills, teamwork. But yeah, it still just wasn't quite right. Like, it was close, but it wasn't quite right. And I knew, again, in combination with the shift work, that that wasn't for me for the rest of my life. So I toddled out into GP training with hope of having some more control over my working hours. And that certainly provided that. And I was working as a GP registrar when COVID kicked off. And that was a really interesting experience. I was covering a couple of nursing homes as well and just managing the risk in that environment. Yeah, really interesting time from a medical point of view. But it was halfway through that term that I managed to regain my Class 1 medical. And suddenly I had the option of restarting my commercial flying career. And in the background of all my junior doctor years, I'd always done whatever flying I could get my hands on. And I had had this sort of slow, gradual return to flying because I had regained the medical standard required to fly ultralights, two-seat aircraft. Then a couple of years later, I'd regained the ability to fly using my private license. And I'd actually set up a little business to be an aviation medical examiner. And I would fly myself around a bunch of country towns that had decent aviation communities, but no local aviation medical examiner. And just prior to COVID kicking off, that had built up to sort of 6 or 7 towns. So I'd disappear for 4 days and fly myself around and do this aviation medical work. And that was great fun because it was a mix of flying and medicine. So when I got my Class 1 medical back and had the option to get back into commercial flying, I thought, well, that's kind of the model. I need to end up in a role where I'm doing some commercial flying and some aviation medicine. And I think I'd made a decision at that point during that GP term that, again, GP wasn't quite right. I was enjoying it, but I wasn't loving it. And if I hadn't got my Class 1 medical back, I probably would have finished the GP training and heavily tailored it to what I like, you know, the procedural stuff and a bit of aviation medicine. But yeah, given the option to go back flying, the goal shifted slightly. So how do I combine what has clearly become my favorite bit of medicine, which is aviation medicine, and my previous professional passion of commercial flying? And then that process started. But of course, COVID had kicked off. So that was a really interesting time because all my pilot colleagues were out of work and I was busier than I'd ever been as a doctor. So it was kind of ironic that, yeah, professionally I was okay, but the field I wanted to get back into wasn't working at all. So, I guess life carried on from there. I focused on aviation medicine from a medical point of view. I only did aviation medicine work from that point onwards. And I started working as a flying instructor and a skydive pilot. And I kind of juggled the balance between those two. And I did more and more of both and got my, I guess, my professional flying back up to a point where I was eligible to reapply to an airline. And as COVID died down and Qantas opened up employment again, I applied as a pilot, so I was re-employed at Qantas as a pilot, but they have been more than happy to utilize me in a dual role because I have this unusual mix of qualifications. So here I am now, 2 days flying and 3 days doctoring and all in-house for Qantas.
Yeah, wow. I'm sure you're a very unique person. They're very lucky to have you in a role like that. I love that it sounds like you felt that real passion in aviation in as a pilot that you sort of chased all through medicine. And it sounds like you've found it again. Now, I want to hear a little bit about your journey to get your pilot's license back and what that involved.
Right. Well, the department that manages aviation is the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, CASA. And they have an aviation medicine branch, AFMED, CASA AFMED, who are responsible for the oversight of all the rules around your medical standards required for private licenses, commercial licenses, etc. And yes, when I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, the rules at that time just said black and white, insulin-dependent diabetes is incompatible with holding a Class 1 medical. However, CASA AFMED are open to changing rules if there is an evidence base on which they can support that rule change. And about the time I got diagnosed, the UK started allowing commercial pilots with insulin-dependent diabetes back into the flight deck. And after a couple of years, I knew that I actually met the requirements to hold a Class 1 medical in the UK, but I wasn't about to uproot me and the family to the UK just to pursue flying. Canada had also been doing the same thing for a little bit longer, and I was at an aviation medicine conference and I had a chat to one of the aviation medicine doctors from CASA and just asked, what would happen? What would happen if I put in an application for a Class 1 medical? And they said, well, it would just be a no because we don't have a protocol, we don't have any precedent here in Australia, we don't have any evidence on which to create something new, so No, it would just be a no. Okay. At least I know the answer. But it was literally that month or the following month that the UK published their experience, published all the data and their experience of the last 4 years of allowing commercial pilots with insulin-dependent diabetes to fly. And it was very supportive. So I thought, wow, I've actually got some published medical evidence now. And I'd been flying little airplanes for several years at this point, and I'd been logging all of my flights in the manner required to meet the UK insulin-dependent pilot protocol. So I had about 700 hours of my own flying data. I had the UK published evidence. So I thought, well, I'll just tinker with the UK protocol, because the UK protocol was developed before continuous glucose monitors were sort of accurate enough to be useful. So I didn't reference them. But by this stage, CGMs were nice and accurate, and I'd been using one for quite a while. So I updated the UK protocol to require the use of CGMs and just submitted that, submitted the evidence base, submitted all my data, and asked the question. Really, the goal was I just tried as hard as possible to put them in a position where they didn't have any reason to say no. And they didn't say no. They didn't say anything. I didn't hear from them for ages. And I can't remember, it was months and months and months later, I got a phone call from one of the doctors in CASA who said, Jeremy, I think we can do something with this. I thought, wow, that's amazing. And then aviation medicine is a very niche corner of medicine. CASA only normally has five-ish doctors full-time and some contract doctors. And just for whatever reason, a number of the doctors, the full-time doctors, left within a very short space of time. And their capacity to do anything new just evaporated. So my project just got put on the back burner for 12 months-ish. And it finally got going again about 2 years later. And I'd been working with CASA and felt I was at a point where things were looking positive. And then COVID kicked off. And suddenly everyone in medicine is running around busier than they've ever been. And I had a little email draft that I was about to send it into CASA to say, look, I think we've all got bigger fish to fry at the moment. Let's just pause this and come back to it when life's calmed down. And I'm glad I didn't send it, because a couple of weeks later, I got a text message from CASA. They have an automated text message service to keep pilots up to date with what's going on with their medical applications. And it said, proceeding to issue your class one medical. And I distinctly remember I was in between patients at the GP clinic where I was working as a registrar. And I just didn't know whether to laugh or cry, because I had been working towards this for 3 years at this point. And I knew that the aviation industry had basically just shut down for an indeterminate period of time. So it was the ultimate irony that I got my medical back just at the point when it actually didn't change anything professionally. So that was the journey back to getting the medical. And I mean, people ask me that exact question, what did you have to do to get your medical back? And you know, my smart ass answer is normally I had to go and become a doctor. And that's really a large component of it. The medical training gave me the skills to be able to communicate to the CASA medical department in medical terms. It would have been a much harder press if I had just been a pilot trying to get this change happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Has that had flow-on effects now? Do they do it as a case-by-case basis, or have you changed their protocol and their guidelines now?
So, yeah, so the protocol has been changed and it is the new accepted standard. But because of the many, many variables involved in insulin-dependent diabetes, each case is assessed on a case-by-case basis. But the flow-on effects have been, at a commercial pilot level, we now have five pilots in the Qantas group who are back flying because of that change. And at a grassroots level, I've actually started to lose track. You know, initially, everyone used to find me and contact me when they had type 1 diabetes and wanted to become a commercial pilot. But it's grown, it's kind of snowballed. But I know we've got probably close to 20 young people out who are either at various stages of learning to fly or in their first job in general aviation because this rule change has happened. So I kind of feel like if I never, ever achieve anything else ever, as long as I live, I'm happy. You know, I've made a useful change for a small group of people.
No, that's huge. Well done. What does it actually look like now? You said they have to wear a CGM. Is that constantly? Is that while they're flying? And are there specific targets that they have to be within? I know, obviously, then you do it case by case, but what's the sort of bare bones of the framework?
No, broadly speaking, it's a slightly different lens with which to look at insulin-dependent diabetes from an aviation medical point of view, because from a treating doctor point of view, you're wanting to minimize the risk of long-term complications. That's the goal, without impacting daily quality of life. From an aviation medicine point of view, we are wanting to minimize the immediate incapacitation risk. Secondary to that is minimizing the risk of long-term complications. because those long-term complications also aren't compatible with holding a Class 1 medical. So when you look at the standards required, they're actually quite broad. So when you're flying the aeroplane, CASA is happy if your blood glucose is anywhere between 5 and 15 millimoles. You know, running around all day at 14 millimoles, that's appalling for your long-term health. But briefly, in the short-term context of incapacitation risk, it's not a problem. So it's a very broad band of acceptable glucose levels whilst you're flying the aeroplane. However, they do want an HbA1c that is less than 8%. So that kind of caps your average glucose levels. You can't be running yourself at 14 millimoles all day, every day, because there's no way you'd achieve an HbA1c of 8 or less. Yes, you must wear a CGM while you're flying, and preferably all the time. You have to log your takeoff and landing times, and you have to submit 12 months of glucose data, including your takeoff and landing times, as part of your annual medical submission. So some poor doctor at CASA has to look through. You know, you can imagine the data points involved here. One glucose reading every 5 minutes for 365 days. But the CGMs now produce excellent summary pages. The ambulatory glucose profile has kind of become the industry standard for reporting, and that provides the kind of information that CASA needs. So that's the core from a flying point of view. And then there's the usual stuff that any doctor would do looking after someone with any kind of diabetes: regular HbA1cs on a 3-monthly basis, annual screening for micro and macrovascular complications, and just make sure that that's all submitted with the medical each year.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds all very logical, but they obviously just needed the right person to be motivated to make the change.
Well, that was it. And it wasn't something that I set out to change. There was a little light bulb moment where I thought, I don't think there's many aviation medicine doctors that are former airline pilots that have type 1 diabetes that would be in an ideal place to do something about this.
No.
I thought, all right, I better do
something.
Picturing
the little chart.
Yeah, the Venn diagram has a very, very small overlap there. Yep.
And if you could go back in time and give a bit of advice to your younger self, is there something that you wish now? Because you sound like you're in a very happy and maybe stable, I don't know if I want to put words into your mouth, place in your career. Is there anything you wish you could tell your younger self from where you are now?
Oh, that's a big question. people often ask me what it was like going through med school with two young children. My son was born 6 months before I started, and my daughter was born at the beginning of third year. And in hindsight, I'm not quite sure how we got through the last couple of years of med school. Yeah, there's definitely no right time to have children. There's probably no right time to do med school either, but possibly just separating them slightly might be good advice. I guess the advice would be to my much younger self, would be just to keep pursuing those things you are interested in, because ultimately that's what's led me to, despite such a significant career shift and an unexpected career shift, has ended up with me still being in a position where I have an interesting career that I find very rewarding. If I hadn't taken advantage of that spare time during my previous Qantas career to pursue some other interests, I wouldn't have met the eligibility requirements to apply to med school.
Mm.
And if I hadn't done med school, then definitely the chance of me actually having a Class 1 medical again would be really, really low, because I wouldn't have been in such a good position to try and get the rules changed. So, yeah, everything has sort of flowed on from every other decision, and it's always kind of come back to, yeah, just pursuing those things you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. The final question we ask everyone that comes on the podcast, which I'm interested to hear this from you, is in another universe where you have a completely different career to what you currently do, which you already have two very unique careers, is there another alternate reality dream career? There's no rules. You don't have to be good at the thing that you want to do. It can be very niche or very mainstream, but what's your alternate reality career?
It would have to be astronaut. I've always wanted to go into space. And that the astronaut career, you know, that mix of exploration and cutting-edge technology and science and research and that kind of jack-of-all-trades aspect that astronauts have to be. You know, I've never done very well at just doing one thing. I'm always happiest when I'm doing lots of things, because I find lots of things interesting.
Yeah.
That would be the ultimate career.
That feels fitting. It feels on brand with everything that you have done on Earth.
Well, and if I'm totally honest, I've actually applied for the astronaut training corps twice through the European Space Agency and have been rejected twice. So, yeah.
What do you have to do to be an astronaut? I have no idea.
Well, you have to do everything. Generally, the people have a very, very strong science research background, or they have a technical test flying background, or they have a medical background that has a lot of expedition or remote, wilderness medicine kind of background, those generalist skills. And then occasionally you meet people who have done, or like one of the US astronauts at the moment, who's a Navy SEAL emergency medicine doctor, pilot, astronaut. And he's only 30 something. But anyway.
Wow. Okay. Well, maybe third time lucky. I feel you're much more qualified than I am for those those descriptions.
Yeah, I'm just, one of the things that I'm most happy about at the moment is that I feel like I've finally kind of arrived somewhere professionally where I'm just happy here for a while. Like, it's been a constant push for the last 15 years, and I'm just happy now just to settle and chill out for a bit and enjoy my work.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was lovely to chat to you, and such a unique and inspiring journey.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. We hope that we'll see you at our upcoming conference, which is taking place Saturday, August 23rd and Sunday, August 24th in Melbourne. We will be bringing together inspiring speakers from all walks of medicine and an equally inspiring audience that we'd love to have you as a part of. Follow us on socials and subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss any announcements. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and elders past, present and emerging.